Good morning, everyone. We're a few in the room, at least, but I understand there's a live audience watching us remotely. My name is Neil Pierre. I'm the chief of the Policy Coordination Branch, Office for ECOSOC Support and Coordination of the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, DESA. That's quite a mouthful, so please chew and digest on it carefully. It's my pleasure to welcome you very warmly to this media briefing this morning. We are really dealing today with the topic, the subject of peace, security, and development. Today there's going to be an important event taking place from 1:15 to 2:30. It's titled No Development Without Peace, Grounding Peace Metrics in the Post-2015 Development Agenda. This is indeed a very important topic, but you don't really want to hear from me about it because I have little that I could contribute. We have, in fact, a panel of experts who are here with us and who are going to really speak to the issue and whet your appetites, hopefully, for this afternoon's discussion. I'd like to introduce, in that order, Danielle Hislop, who is the Research Director, Institute for Economics and Peace, Ms. Michelle Breslauer, Director, U.S. Operations, Institute for Economics and Peace, and Ms. Lucy Hurst, Associate Director, Custom Research, the Economist Intelligence Unit. Let me invite Michelle Breslauer to give some introductory remarks, and I'll open up for questions from anyone. Thank you very much. Michelle?
Thank you. Daniel, Lucy, and I are here today on behalf of the Institute for Economics and Peace and our partner, the Economist Intelligence Unit. We produce a peace index each year, the Global Peace Index, which looks at ranking countries according to their levels of peacefulness. And the reason that we put this index together each year is because the Institute for Economics and Peace is dedicated to trying to measure peacefulness, understand the drivers of peace, and ascribe an economic cost to peace. The index itself is put together by a three-part process. It's the Institute for Economics and Peace, an independent panel of experts, and the Economist Intelligence Unit. So there is a peer review of the methodology and the results each year to ensure independence. We take a key definition of peace as the absence of violence or the absence of fear of violence. And that's the basis and the conceptual foundation for the index. And then we look at correlating the index against a number of socioeconomic factors to understand the common attitudes, institutions, and structures of peaceful societies. So we also put together something called a positive peace index that we'll actually speak more to in the event later today. The Global Peace Index itself is composed of 22 indicators measuring internal and external levels of peacefulness. We look at levels of militarization in society, indicators of societal safety and security, and organized conflict. So once we have the index, I'm going to just go through some of the key results for this year. We'll be presenting the index more in depth today, and we'll be talking about the relationships that we looked at between peace and development, and also the correlations between peace and the different themes from the post-2015 development agenda that are being addressed. This year, the GPI found that peace has declined slightly in the past year. This is primarily due to a rise in internal levels of violence. So we've seen an increase in homicide rates, which have gone up 8% globally. These homicide rates have gone up primarily in Central America and Sub-Saharan Africa. So they're not all regionally distributed, but also levels of internal organized conflict deaths have gone up. So the number of deaths from internal organized conflict has also risen in the past year. What we're seeing as a global trend over 6 years, in fact, is that conflict has tended to shift from wars between states to internal conflicts between citizens. Criminal violence is still much more attributed to deaths than internal conflicts or to interstate wars. In terms of looking at the rankings, this year we see Iceland continue to maintain its most peaceful position, followed by Denmark and New Zealand, and then Austria. Austria has actually risen slightly in the index this year. And at the bottom, the least peaceful country is Afghanistan. So Afghanistan, while it's always been in the bottom 10 since the index started, is now at the very bottom again. Afghanistan actually is less peaceful now in 2013 than it was in 2008. Afghanistan followed by Somalia, Syria, and then Iraq. Syria has dropped in the index by 70%. It is the biggest faller we've ever seen in the index, and the first index came out in 2007. I'm going to leave some of the key highlights there, and we'll probably open for questions, which can also be related to some of the correlations and the structures that we've seen, the common structures, attitudes, and institutions that we've identified as helping to sustain a peaceful society.
Good. Thank you very much, Michelle. I think you have quite a lot to go on there, colleagues, so the floor is open. You can pose questions to Michelle or any other member of our panel this morning. As I said, let me just mention their names again. We have Danielle Hislop from the Institute of Economics and Peace, Lucy Hurst from the Economist Intelligence Unit, and you just heard from Michelle Breslauer, also from the Institute of Economics and Peace. The floor is open for questions. Please identify yourselves briefly and go ahead.
Sure, thanks a lot. I'm Matthew Lee from Inner City Press. Also on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access, I want to thank you for doing this briefing. Sorry, you're competing with the Security Council meeting and a lot of other stuff. But I wanted to ask you, I noticed, I mean, obviously there's a lag in putting out these reports, but Mali, for example, is a country that's burst onto the scene. So I'm wondering if you could sort of posit, if there's anything that you could say of whether they would, you know, sadly, break into this, you know, bottom five. Where you think they would fall, given the events there? Also, I noticed that Haiti is it doesn't really appear. It comes out sort of in the middle in the Caribbean and the Americas. And there is a UN peacekeeping mission there. So I'm sort of wondering what you can, since we're here at the UN, how you can sort of tie this into the idea of is there any correlation between the relative, you know, lack of peace in a country and the Security Council sending a mission, or is it somewhat a more political determination? Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your question. In terms of Mali, it is ranked fairly low on the index. It's 125th. It did fall quite significantly in the past year. Not all of the violence that we've seen in Mali, in reality, has flown through to the index. So there is some lagging aspects. I would expect that if there is a continuation, you would probably see Mali, you know, fall in subsequent years. One thing to note about it, when we look at the institutions that facilitate peace, what we call the Positive Peace Index, Mali certainly was one of those countries that lacked institutional capacity and also had vulnerabilities. In a sense, it was vulnerable prior to the conflict. In terms of Haiti, Haiti is another country that has lacked institutional capacity and has been a big faller in previous years. But it bouncing back from its from the natural disaster from internal conflict in the past 6 years, it's actually probably a relative positive story in the GPI. You know, we've seen it increase, and I think we can probably give you the actual details of the ranking and exactly what indicators have increased for Haiti.
Yes, there are a number of areas where Haiti's improved over the past... There are a number of areas where Haiti has improved over the past year. We see an increase in internal security with a police force increase, jail population down, terrorist activity on the decrease, and a number of deaths from organized conflict, internal, having had an improved score. It looks like some of the other capacity areas, like nuclear and heavy weapons capabilities, there's been an improvement in the score there. And several other areas, number of refugees and displaced people, an improvement, number of external and internal conflicts fought, and estimated number of deaths from organized conflict. So just to go over some of the indicator areas. The constraint to Haiti's improvement does tend to be the level of violent crime, where it does score in the bottom quartile.
Thank you both. The floor is still open for questions. Yes, please.
We look at both.
Just the microphone.
We look at both qualitative and quantitative indicators, and I'll let actually Lucy explain how the qualitative indicators are scored, as well as if either one of you want to comment on perceptions of criminality indicator in the index.
Yeah, thank you. The EIU is involved in helping to score some qualitative and quantitative indicators, as Michelle indicated. And to level of perceived criminality in society is actually one of those key qualitative indicators for the index. We typically employ our country analysis team, those based either in London or New York and few other remote locations around the world, but they are know their countries quite well, and they are used to following these issues on a day-to-day basis for our regular EIU work. And we bring that experience and insight to this index and ask them to set up basically a scoring schematic, a five-point scale on which countries are ranked on this score. And in terms of the level of perceived criminality in society, they look at things like a very low score would be, which would be a good score, would mean that the majority of citizens can be trusted and they're very low levels of domestic activity. So there's very low criminality. All the way up to the top score, or the worst score, as it were, would be very high levels of distrust in other citizens. People are extremely cautious in their dealings with others, and there are a large number of gated communities and security guards. So we have that spectrum through which we consider the activity in the society.
The other thing I would add, it's a very important area to try and capture perceptions data, and certainly if there was better data in this area, survey data, then that would be something that we would consider. Expert assessment is the best thing that can be done given the current stock of data. I think the other thing that's important to point out is when we get these scores, the expert panel plays a very important role in vetting them and checking them, and we have to ensure that there's a peer review process. So the scores really do reflect broadly what is actually happening.
Very, very, very important observations, I must say. If I might add, also on the basis of the question about qualitative data, one way of getting qualitative information, of course, is through focus group discussions, etc. That is, of course, a lot more expensive, and so. But to what extent is that tried in any of the countries? And the other observation I wanted to add is, very often it's not just a perception of the absence of crime, but or the perception of the presence of crime, but the perception of people's general well-being and the absence of crime and how that interacts with their welfare. The other, and then if I might add one last question, What are the sources for your quantitative data on for various countries?
Sure. In terms of to what extent do we collect on the ground qualitative data? We can't because of the cost. One of the things that we have to think about when we're building an index, we do need to harmonize the data across 162 countries, and we need to be comparing apples with apples. And it's just not possible with the current stock of data to do that. There are some sources like the Gallup World Poll, which is very comprehensive, but there are problems of representation, and we really don't have a really good data source at the moment. And I think that's why it's sort of been highlighted as one of the key issues in the post-2015 development agenda. Certainly, what we're trying to do when we're measuring these things is to capture not just the absence of violence, but also the absence of the fear of violence. That's very important. And that's what this qualitative indicator is trying to do. It's trying to capture people's perceptions about fear on the ground.
Very good. Thank you very much, Daniel. There's another question from the audience, and the floor is still open for questions. Please go ahead.
I'm writing a paper regarding peace education is really affecting on
There's probably a microphone.
Thank you. But it was really difficult for me to define the education can be a source of affecting on the peace building and socially and economically the country itself. So can I say that, but Global Peace Index is very good tool to analyze the social economic peace in one country. So do you think one element like education, especially peace education, can be a source of affecting on peace building or other areas in country? Thank you.
Thanks for your question. Within the GPI, we don't have any measure of education outcomes because we're trying to measure the absence of violence and the absence of the fear of violence. But certainly education is a very important facilitator of peace. And what we do in our Positive Peace Index, which is looking at the institutions, attitudes and structures which help facilitate a more peaceful society, that framework has eight parts, and it's a framework to help us think about what are the key factors that will build a more peaceful society. One of the pillars is high levels of human capital, which is very much about education and youth development. And certainly education outcomes, mean years of schooling, levels of literacy are quite strongly associated with more peaceful environments. So the countries that are higher in the GPI will tend to have better health education outcomes. In terms of peace education, that's very difficult area, partly because to do analysis, it's quite difficult. There's not much data on how much peace education is actually occurring on the ground in many places, but we certainly know that qualitatively it's a very important thing. I don't know if Michelle wants to add to that.
Good. Thank you very much, Daniel. Any further questions, please? Definitely. Yours.
Okay, great. I wanted to, ask sort of how you, obviously you have to kind of make judgments in doing this. I'm thinking like, first of all, like how do you decide, there are conflicting numbers of how many people, for example, have been killed in Syria, as there were in Sri Lanka. And so there are big numbers, and obviously there's implications of which number you choose. So how, if you could use maybe the example of Syria, because it's one in which there's widely differing numbers. How do you decide on that? And then I was reading the section on Bahrain, and it says, you know, this is more about the sort of the text of the report. It says, Bahrain continues to be affected by increasingly violent protests, largely from the country's Shia majority. So I can imagine some reading it and saying, actually, the protests were peaceful. It's the government that was violent. So how, I mean, how kind of is the text vetted, and is that, is there, what can you say about the idea of just sort of looking at violence? Obviously, most people are interested in sort of like which side is causing the violence. And then finally, just like, because it's newsy, is recent events in Turkey. I mean, how would this play into the index if it's a matter of tear gas as opposed to you know, bullets? But I guess that's just an open-ended question. Thanks.
Thanks. So first part of the question, Syria, certainly right. There have been many conflicting numbers reported. The data source that we use for number of organized conflict deaths is really trying to measure armed conflict deaths, and it's from the International Institute of Strategic Studies, IISS. They publish these numbers yearly. Those tend to be the gold standard for social science research. The number that we have for Syria this year is 72,900, I think, that died from conflict deaths, armed conflict deaths in 2012. Of course, there have been numbers as high as 120,000 reported. But of course, these numbers do move around, and it's often only until a year or two after the fact that reassessments get done and those numbers get finalized. So, to some extent, it's an intractable problem. We just have to rely on the quality of the data, but we're trying to use the best quality data out there. To the second part of the question, I think it's really important to emphasize that the GPI is not trying to make value judgments about why violence is happening or who's to blame or which actors involved. We should sort of apportion blame to. I think what the exercise is really about is trying to measure the levels of physical violence, political terror, terrorism, internal conflict, homicides, levels of violent crime. We're trying to provide a multidimensional measure of violence in all its forms. We're not trying to say these are the countries that are responsible for X, or these are the actors that are responsible for B. In terms of Turkey, certainly I think the violent demonstrations that we've seen will be reflected in the violent demonstration indicator in next year's GPI. We obviously don't see those changes in this year's GPI because they're very recent events. We may also see an increase in political instability depending on how circumstances go in the next 12 months. So it is an open-ended question. We can speculate, but there are indicators that are directly linked to what's happening in Turkey.
Good. I think I'm going to leave it open for one last question if anyone has a burning desire to pose a question. And I think not. I'm not sure if Michelle or Danielle or Lucy would like to make a closing comment before I bring this formally to a close. Would any one of you like to?
I just wanted to add, each year, part of the exercise is not just to try to measure levels of violence, but to also assess the economic impact. So we do actually put together a number each year that tries to account for not just the cost of direct violence to the world economy, but also what are we losing in terms of productivity costs because of the levels of violence or lack of peace. And so this year, we found that for 2012, the cost of violence to the global economy was $9.4 trillion, which is about 11% of world GDP. In the reports that we have here, but that are also available online on our website, which is economicsandpeace.org, you can actually see the cost of violence broken down per country. as well as read the analysis of the Global Peace Index and Positive Peace Index. But I also want to point you to visionofhumanity.org, which is a website that we have that includes interactive maps. So you can go on actually into each country and look at every indicator and every score over a number of years.
Thank you very much, Michelle. And thank you all colleagues for coming and for being interested in this topic. I'd like to really urge everyone to attend this afternoon's presentation and bring a friend and a colleague along as well. Spread the word, simply because this is a very important topic. The majority of developing countries are indeed affected by issues of violent crime and its and conflict and their impact on development, social, economic, and environmental development, I might add. I'd like to thank our panelists, who you'll be hearing more from later today, but I would like also to sum up some of the real substantive takeaways for me from this very brief engagement we've had this morning. Number one, that is that there has been a decline in the peace index for a number of countries. Number two, that there has been a rise in internal violence, particularly in many cases accounted for by homicides, an increase in homicide rates. And this, of course, has caused some countries to go up in the scale. This is against a shift from what previously was the case of violence predominantly between countries. We're seeing it now manifested mainly as internal violence within countries. And we know that these are there are significant impacts on development, particularly economic impact, loss of productivity, resources spent on peacekeeping, security, and policing, etc. And we can measure this in numerous other ways. We also know that the index is based on a methodology that is composed both of quantitative and qualitative sources of data, and it's peer-reviewed, and countries are ranked according to both measures. That would be my takeaway. You will all have your takeaways. With reports of this sort, they're always subject to interpretation, and I believe, as Michelle said, the idea is not to point fingers at particular countries or sources of violence, but to demonstrate the fact that violence does exist and its impact on economic and social development. Thank you all very much, and see you this afternoon.